You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Evolution. I'm Colin from Warwickshire in England.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. And Colin is our guest for tonight's show. Colin, let me see when you were on last. I'm sure you and James have already got it, but here it is, Manhunt, which you gave it a 3, so did James, and I gave it a 2.
Yeah, that seems a long time ago now.
Yes, March 14th.
Yeah.
It was my birthday that day.
It was,
Pi Day.
Pi Day, yeah.
And we specifically referenced Pi Day on the episode.
Yes, my daughter was driving me crazy with Pi Day.
All right. It's your birthday. You don't like to have pie on your birthday.
Yeah, right. I should have. So, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, since maybe we may have picked up a few audience members, because I reached out to a podcast called Mission Log. You guys familiar with that?
I've heard of it, yeah.
Okay.
Isn't this the Roddenberry-backed one?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
Episode reviews.
Yes, and there, you know, the one I heard, the first one I heard him on, had Will Wheaton, and so that was a lot of fun listening to Will Wheaton stuff that I don't think he's ever talked about before, and you know, and Roddenberry was on that podcast, so check it out, guys. It's going to be at missionlogpodcast.com, and since I reached out to him, they're following us on Twitter now, and you know the Twitter effect, you know, when people like something that's, you know, really popular and they follow you, other people are going to reach out. So I do want to say hello to any new member of the audience that we are going to be picking up here as we begin season 3.
Sorry, if I can stop you,
if you are on Twitter, then tweet Lou Trek Show and put hashtag Star Trek.
There you go.
People look for hashtags. So, okay. And then Lou will get more listeners via the hashtag.
Yes, please. So that'd be nice. Tell them again.
Lou Trek Show is on Twitter. And reference the show, reference James as well, and put hashtag Star Trek.
Mm.
Because all that people do is they go on the Twitter, they go on the search, and they put Star Trek in. And anything with the hashtag on front of it, Twitter will automatically flag up.
So I'm going to test that, okay, because I've never been told to do that. So I'm going to log into Twitter at this time under Lou Trek Show. So what do I put down and what's happening?
Just put your tweet, put now recording TNG Evolution, hashtag Star Trek.
Hashtag Star Trek. Really? Okay, so now recording Evolution with our buddy Colin. What's yours? Hashtag.
No, if you put at with at.
Uh-huh. At.
Mine's C-O-L-M-H 01.
C-O-L-M-H.
C-O-L.
C-O-L.
M-H 01.
They're yards, Colin.
Yeah. Is yours, you on there, James?
And what's James?
You don't want me on that.
No, you're part of the show. You got to be on there. Come on. You don't have a Twitter?
I am on. Lou, you follow me on Twitter.
Well, I know that, but. Oh, here we go. James Robert.
TNG Rewatch. That's yes. A good one.
Okay. And then I put hashtag Star Trek. And nothing else?
That's it.
Okay. All right. Then here we go. Let's tweet it. Boom.
Oh, blimey. I've just been mentioned on the tweet.
What a shock.
Hey.
It's almost as if you didn't know that was going to happen.
I just wanted to surprise you, Doc. Okay. Anyway. All right. So, Colin, what are you up to lately? Where have you been?
I'll retweet that later on my Star Trek account, because that's got 3,000 followers on it. So
there you go. Every little bit helps, bud.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell us what you've been up to.
Well, not a lot, actually, because I've had various medical problems since the end of last year, which finally got sorted. So basically, I've just been getting back to work and mm-hmm. doing lots of overtime to earn the money that I haven't earned for God knows how many months. I stopped doing my own Star Trek podcast. So I no longer have a Star Trek podcast for the first time in 5 years. That's kind of weird. But I still tweet and I still do the Trek News and Views tweets. So I'm still involved in it, and I get to come on this show and talk Star Trek, so
well,
it's all good. And Melissa says that she'll have me on Upper Pylon too at some point as well, so I'm looking forward to that.
Yes, yeah, we were invited for there as well, and I appreciate that, Melissa. I'll try and figure out one of the DS9s that I really, really like. I don't want to just come on just for the sake of coming on. It has to be special. So. Yeah.
But she's put a good crew together there.
Oh my goodness. You know, we just brought it up briefly that they were running, and I've got to tell you, in the episodes that I've heard, it's been terrific. The way they put it together, it is very Delta Quadrant-ish, but it seems like it's a lot more lively.
Yeah, and it's also at a different viewpoints, because obviously they've got an atheist, Melissa's a Christian, so tackling the Bajoran's religion comes from various different angles, which is also very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all the philosophical viewpoints, because DS9 is very philosophical in some segments.
Yeah.
So the diversity is really, really good. It's like you two. It's like you two, when you get into some of your conversations, you make me laugh, because James does the logical, scientific approach, and you're just like, what are you talking about? You can't do that.
I try to be as flippant as I can, or not flippant, but I try to bring out the funny aspect, and James is the analytical. So, I mean, I have no compunctions of who's the better podcaster between us two. Of course, that's me.
No, but it's two sides of the coin.
Exactly. No. I think for honest, real evaluation of an episode, James has got it. Whereas I just kind of like him. I'm the guy who spoke over the Dukes of Hazzard. You know, and then James is a guy who really beats it home. Does that matter?
This is nonsense. I'm a mumbling idiot. Lou, you had your own show for like 200-odd episodes.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah, but there's no comparison here. It didn't take off like this has. I mean, let's face that. This has been phenomenal compared to Lou Trek Show. So, Lou Trek Show was a build-up to doing this, and I hope that we do go on to DS9. But
from small acorns, big oak trees grow.
Absolutely, yes. Although Brian Dedamore just wrote me, he wants to do something for Lou Trek Show. He wants to interview somebody, and I can't remember the whole thing. So we may pull out a show or two and see what's going on. But not to bring us down, but after Brian Baker died, I just don't have any feeling for it no more. So I'm hoping Dedamore and I can maybe do something to spark it back to life.
Well, that's understandable. You know, you get into a certain groove with someone and they're not there anymore. You know, you've got to, you know, try and reignite the fire or
let it go.
Find a new hoppo.
Yeah, let it go. You know, and I keep it going mainly for the RSS feed so people will listen to this show. We still have some following the old RSS in... That's the way I want to keep it going. But anyway, okay, then let's go ahead and continue on there, Colin.
Okay. Well, the synopsis for tonight's show is an obsessed scientist arrives on the Enterprise D to perform a once-in-a-lifetime experiment, unless you're a Vulcan. Accidentally released nanites, however, threaten both it and the ship. This is the first episode of Season 3 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date is September the 12th, 1989. It was written by Michael Piller and Michael Wagner and directed by Winrich Kobe. Guest stars include Whoopi Goldberg, who's brilliant as Guinan. I love Whoopi. and Mary McCusker as nurse, and Randall Patrick as crewman number one.
That's funny that they actually named them as a generic location. And of course, it's before you say anything more, it's important to note Dr. Pulaski is gone, and Dr. Crusher, played by Gates McFadden, is back.
And I do address that in this episode.
Mm-hmm. But by the way, where's Dr. Stubbs in that list of guest stars? He must get a mention at least, right?
Jeez. Yeah. Wait.
I mean, is he a special appearance?
Oh, there we go. No, yeah, you're right. It's guest star Ken Jenkins as Paul Stubbs. I missed that completely. Oh, and I put co-stars. Okay, so I did the whole thing wrong. That's why the nurse and the crewman were on there. They shouldn't have been.
Well, you got guest star Ken Jenkins as Paul Stubbs, special guest star Whoopi Goldberg as Guinan, co-stars Mary McCusker as nurse, and Randall Patrick as crewman number one.
All right, so crewman number one, you've become mentioned.
Yay! He probably got his whole family around that telly to watch that day.
I think I'll send an email to him saying if you want to see how you've been immortalized in Star Trek history, listen to this show. Okay.
He's bound to be at a convention somewhere.
Yeah. Dressed as himself.
Yeah.
I was crewman. It reminds me of a Galaxy Quest, you know?
But the guy who plays the Gorn does the convention circuit, so...
Really?
Yeah.
So now, that's Bobby Clark, right? The guy that does the Gorn.
Yeah.
Now, I've mentioned this before. I specifically mentioned it at when I was going to get some stuff signed. I'm pretty sure that it was the first Star Trek London that we had here, and they got some decent writers. So they got Brian Braga, Ron D. Moore, and Ira Stephen Baer. And those three guys were sitting in a row, and next to them was the dude in the Gorn suit. And I walked straight up to, I think at this point I was talking to Ron D. Moore, because I wanted to get some Battlestar stuff signed, and I had one of my kids with me at that point as well. I was astonished that there was no one waiting for any of the writers. And they're not just lowly writers, right? They were, executive producers.
No,
of
these
DS9.
Are the guys that created DS9 and Battlestar Galactica
and Voyager as well with Brian Braga and stuff. And some really, really good stuff. No one wanted to talk to them, but there was a queue for Bobby Clark, and I just didn't quite get it. I think he had more people wanted to see him than Walter Koenig had, and I just didn't get it.
You know what you got? I had the gold pass. I don't know what you had, James, but on the gold pass, you had a certain number of autographs included in your pack.
Okay, you think he was overrepresented with those?
Yes, Bobby Clark was in my pack. So if a lot of gold people had Bobby Clark in their pack, that would explain the queue.
Perhaps that's it.
But I did get Ronald D. Moore's autograph. I actually got a chance to talk to Iron Stephen Baer for about 5 minutes, and I got him to do a voice message for a friend in America, and I also had a quick chat with Brandon Braga about Enterprise.
That good guys, and they will really talk to you. And
that was great. I mean, Artie Stephen Baer, he literally asked, says, can you do a message from a friend in America who's called Mike, who's a massive fan, and he said sure, and he took my phone off me. Did press record, did him a 2 or 3 minute message, press pause, and says, "Was that okay?" And I went, "Yeah." And he says, "Okay, there you go."
I remember I went to one of the speeches with Avery Brooks, and on a couple of occasions, and I think this is what Avery Brooks was saying was correct, is that people were throwing questions over to Avery, and he was saying, "Look, I don't know, I didn't write the show. Ira Stephen Baer's here, ask him." And in a way, you really should be. People should be more concentrated on asking the creators behind the scenes, as what people's motivations were, and how they saw things, rather than the actors. And I was surprised how little how little attention these guys got in comparison to the man in the Gorn suit.
I went up and got them because I think they're brilliant, and I love Battlestar Galactica. I mean, something that, but I also it was also weird because there's people like Nana Vista,
mm-hmm.
and there was no one at her table either. And I'm thinking, that's like, really, like, how can Nana Vista be there and no one's getting their autograph? You know, some of the tables with the people who are at the tables, and you're thinking, I don't, and then you get people like, I mean, not to diminish his role, but Manu Interami, he's very popular. He had a fairly big queue for someone who came into Voyager quite late.
Yeah. And then I also went up to, I mean, Mark Alemo, no one talking to him, no interest. And you think, this guy's great. I mean, it is strange, you know,
you've got the guy who played the Gorn who's got a queue. You got Manu Interami who's got a queue. And in between them is people like Anana Vista and Nora Stephen Bear and Ronald Dean, but there's no one there. Anyway.
So what do we think of this episode, guys? Colin, what do you think of the episode?
Personally, I mean, I'm sure there's certain aspects of it, especially the physics side, that are going to drive James nuts. But personally, I think, bearing in mind when this was broadcast and bearing in mind its time, it was at the time when nanotechnology was like this wonderful new thing that people had discovered, and it's going to change the world, and we're going to have robots inside us, operated on us, and all these type of stuff. And that was the inspiration behind this story. But I also think it's interesting because it's one of the few times where Wesley messes up and he doesn't get a pat on the back at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's various instances in TNG through the years where Wesley saves the ship and he gets all the credit. But the reason Wesley has to save the ship is because Wesley put the ship in danger in the first place.
Right.
And this is one of the few ones where he puts the ship in danger in the first place and doesn't get a pat on the back.
Mm-hmm.
And also comes up against basically an older version of himself. And I think that the contrast between the two is great. And, you know, Data does, you know, another character in one of his typical, they can hook into me and take over my thing, even though I can't interaccess with the computer via Wi-Fi. But hey, I can put my hand under this and get nanites in me. But anyway. But it's one of the episodes where we see two promotions. Worf gets promoted and Geordi gets promoted in this episode as well.
What?
Oh, didn't you pick up on that?
So by the time the episode airs, now Geordi is Lieutenant Commander and Worf is full Lieutenant. Whereas in the last episode, or, you know, roll back two maybe if you have bad memories of the last episode, they are full Lieutenant and Lieutenant Junior Grade.
Yeah. So they got bumped up a bit during the closed season.
So this means that Geordi was originally Junior Grade in Season 1.
Yeah.
Full in Season 2, and then now Lieutenant Commander.
Yeah, so basically Geordi gets a promotion every season.
And we never see an on-screen promotion for Data in 25 years.
No.
So, hold on a second. So you're saying in Season 2, during The Child, when Geordi is promoted to Chief Engineer, he's still a lieutenant?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a lieutenant senior grade.
Oh, okay. And everybody under him are lieutenant junior grades?
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily.
Well, some are ensigns.
But I think that it's... I believe it was Data Logan, right, that mentioned that, you know, there's a difference between someone's rank and someone's position. So there's nothing preventing, a full Lieutenant Geordi commanding a set of lieutenant commanders under him.
Well, no, I mean, there's that instance where Geordi's in command of the saucer section and he's junior to the other guy, but he's in command.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. And that's in Season 1 you're right. The Lieutenant... Logan. I got there in time. When Logan comes up, he's Lieutenant Commander, and at that point, it's Lieutenant Junior Grade Geordi.
Mm. Yeah, and also, Data's a higher rank than Geordi, but when Data's in engineering, Geordi's in command.
Good point. Okay, I never realized that. Okay. And Worf finally got his promotion that it was well overdue, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
He gets to growl in a more senior rank.
Okay. All right, James, what's your initial impressions?
Well, actually, so I I think I mentioned at the end of Shades of Grey, it was just like, it was, I do like, she wasn't Shades of Grey, sorry, it was the end of the last show that we recorded on The Wrath of Khan. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that I didn't think there's anything wrong at all with Evolution. Rewatching it, I think it wasn't as good as I remembered it, but I still think it's relatively solid. I had some serious issues with how they wrap things up at the end and how very quickly you seem to have developed a huge civilization of nanites. You've found the planet, you've dumped them off the planet, and you've effectively pressed a reset button halfway through a scene. There's some stuff I'm going to bring up, but I like it. I think it's good enough. This is Michael Piller coming into Star Trek, who effectively goes on to helm along with Rick Berman for the rest of the TNG era, and obviously sets up both Deep Space Nine and Enterprise. I think that we're on a pretty solid footing. If this is what, I think this is one of the weaker episodes of season 3, but if this is one of the weaker episodes, I think we're really into good territory now.
There are a few good moments that we will be talking about. I liked Dr. Stubbs. He didn't seem like the Zach Dorn. Kal Rami, is that his name?
Yeah, from Peak Performance.
Yes. Yeah. He wasn't quite that arrogant, but it was close. So there are a few things I do like. But we start season 3 asleep, actually. Wesley falls asleep during an experiment, and Commander Riker has to wake him up. actually, Khan, that is interesting. Go back there. How do you find out how many people replied? I got one star, favorited. How do you see?
Just going to notifications, the middle one.
It
looks like a bell.
Yeah, I got 6 notifications. And that's what I was going to ask you when we were done with this episode, but I might as well do it now before I forget. I got 3 emails that Simon Foster replied, Mike Jarek favorited one, Paula replied or favorited one. It seems like Mike Jarek and a couple others, as soon as our show goes out, they're already retweeting them. Is there some kind of program that does that automatically?
No. Mike's just on the ball.
Yeah, these. Let it be put on record that these people are nice people.
Oh yeah,
that's
Mike, fundamentally Mike does, what they are. Mike does the Gatecast podcast.
Yeah,
which is a Stargate podcast, and he's very on the, he's very very supportive of other podcasts as well. He's very supportive.
Okay.
So if another podcast puts something out and it's one of the ones that Mike's listens to or knows about, then Mike will retweet it.
Nice.
Straight away. He's brilliant like that. Mike is.
Okay. Well, I just assume that there are some people that had some kind of program running. If you see this particular person tweet, send it back out on here. And I thought it was automatic. So now it's even nicer to find out that these people are actually doing it like this. And that's something that I need to get into doing myself. It's build a network. I just have not done that. As you can tell, I'm still a Twitter novice. So thank you to everyone who actually is listening to the show and does that. I'm going to keep this part in. Thank you so much for doing that. Every little bit helps. So anyway, I'm sorry. Back to the episode. Let's see. Our real mission here in this episode was to study the decay of neutronium expelled at relativistic...
Can I just say something before you move on?
Relativistic.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
When Wesley comes onto the bridge, what was that thing that Riker was doing with his finger?
Pointing at him like, you better never do that.
and he tracked him all the way to his chair like he was like at the laser in his finger and he was guiding him to the chair. It was really weird.
Maybe that's what it was. Yeah.
When I watched that scene, I just thought, what are you doing?
I always thought it was a, this ain't like you. See, you're not as perfect as you think you are.
Well, yeah, there is that. Just like, goading him a bit, but it's just so weird to watch. Anyway, sorry. Carry on.
Okay, the decay of neutronium expelled at relativistic speeds. Did I say that right?
Yep.
From a massive stellar explosion, which will occur in a matter of hours. All right, Doc, school us. What did they just say?
So I have been mentioning to Lou throughout this recording session, that doesn't just include this week, but also includes the next week's show, that during our kind of brief hiatus, I've managed to catch up with all of the podcasts that we've been putting out, or more precisely that Lou has put out. As a result, I have only very recently become aware that Lou has this school us button on his sound grid.
Get your books out, kids, because Dr. Roberts is about to school ya.
So I was very happy to hear that a couple of weeks ago. Obviously a couple of weeks ago in the show's perspective. So what was the question? What do you want to know?
Basically, what are they doing in English?
Yeah, what are they doing in English? They're studying the decay of neutronium that is expelled at really fast speeds.
Yeah, so neutronium is just a type of hydrogen. There's going to be a big explosion. This thing's going to be shot out very, very fast. When they talk about relativistic, they're talking about stuff that is close enough to the speed of light as so that, you know, special relativity applies, or at least applies in measurable effects. So basically, there's going to be a big explosion and stuff's going to go fast. That's all.
Okay. But until then, we're okay.
Yeah, but they make it sound that it's going to be exciting, and it doesn't sound that exciting.
No.
Mm-mm. Well, it's the Dr. Stubbs.
Yeah, it is. He's been waiting for this one. And if we don't get it, we have to wait another 180 years. Okay, here's one that you may think that I'm acting ignorant on, but I really am. I have no idea what this is. What is the... it said it's the interstellar counterpart to Earth's Old Faithful. What does that mean, Earth's Old Faithful?
So that's a geyser, right, in Yosemite?
Yellowstone.
Or is it Yellowstone? Maybe Yellowstone.
It's Yellowstone.
All he's saying there is that there are certain things in the world that can, like, let off at a certain, you know, at a periodic basis. And all he's saying there is that this thing explodes at clockwork and Old Faithful. I don't know if it does, but I suppose the implication is that that also goes like clockwork.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I have no
idea. Except Old Faithful doesn't go every 196 years.
Yeah. Well, let me see here. I just put down what is Earth Old Faithful in Google.
Yeah, it is Yellowstone, not Yosemite.
Erupting almost every 63 minutes. Okay, so there we go. Good enough. We'll leave it at that. So it's time to launch the egg. But no, computer failures on the ship cause a delay of the launch. The ship's attitude and impulse control are gone, and they're drifting into the path of the stellar matter. Oh, and by the way, Dr. Stubbs is knocked around like a rag doll. So when they approach this stellar matter, and you hear them say, prepare for impact, seemed pretty minor, didn't it?
Well, I suppose when he says, well, I took it as if he said prepare for impact, he meant to prepare for impact into, like, the solar stream, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So, as opposed to prepare for impact, because we're going to come to a stop really, really quick.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't see much of an impact, because it seemed like everybody's bracing. And
well, yeah, but, you know, where's the inertial dampeners when you need them?
You never know how well the inertial dampeners are going to work. So,
which is why they should have seatbelts.
Oh, I don't think it would matter, would it? I mean, you know, the forces upon the body anyway, whether you have seatbelt, it'd just keep you there while it squashes you, I suppose.
Yeah, but at least it's easy to clean up afterwards because it's all in one place.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, Dr. Stubbs did get, you know, he was rolling along the ground, so at least he could have, you know, not been hit into the wall. Having a couple of those rolls isn't great. Now, one question that I have is that, as a scientist, and I do have a couple of issues with how they choose to bring in the scientist nut job and how they portray him. It is a bit, you know, it is a bit regressive given Star Trek's supposed to be, you know, there's a vision of the future and a lot of it's based on us tackling the world's problems and tackling it through technology and science. But this dude, is he supposed to work alone? I mean, usually scientists should have a team, and I'm surprised that this is, you know, this guy is portrayed as a, you know, a single loner.
well, maybe a bunch of scientists
that managed to see this. Is I do echo Colin's point. So
maybe he's, hold on. He's getting impression
of that link. Well, stop everyone. Stop everyone. We were all, believe it or not, we were all in three different time frames. Okay.
Can I be future Enterprise?
I don't even know where we were. Colin, go ahead. Say what we were going to say.
I was going to say, he did say this was his life's work.
Yes.
So I kind of presume that he was there as a representative of the team, because he could, you can have like a link back to a starbase or somewhere when the data starts coming in for the rest of the team to look at. They don't all have to be there.
Okay. James?
No, I agree. But I also was about to echo something that Colin said earlier, which is that to a very large extent, I think that the Dr. Stubbs character is at least a mirror image of he's an older version of the Wesley character. Mm. So I think that these two do interact with each other. And you almost get the impression that the writers are trying to say that, you know, with Wesley's enthusiasm, the right word, obsession over his work and so on, you can see that replicated in Stubbs, and you might even suggest that this is, you know, even a warning for Wesley as to how he shouldn't become so obsessive in his work, because you end up as this, you know, sad old loner that starts getting a gamma ray gun and shooting it at computer cores when you can't you know, do your experiment right.
Would they address that in the next scene when he's inspecting the egg?
Mm-hmm.
And he does the Wonder Kid speech.
Yep. I have a note on the... now, I don't speak German, but I can get what Wonder Kid means.
That did make me laugh. Wesley's supposed to be this seriously intelligent person, and he can't work out what Wonder Kid is in relation to Wonder Kid. That did make me laugh.
You know, there are certain words you can kind of pick up, right? And Wonder Kid really should be one of them.
Yeah, most European languages have a Latin base, so, you know, there is familiarity in the words.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and now I'm going to prove what I mean by I look at Star Trek as not as analytical, which is why I like having Dr. Roberts on. Back up to why was he the only person on this expedition? And I thought, well, maybe Starfleet had a competition to whoever can build this device that would study neutronians at fast speeds, and his prototype won out above all the rest.
Feasible, but bearing in mind that we know it only happens one in every 196 years. How long ago did I start the competition?
Oh, probably 25, 30 years ago. It was a Google competition, by the way. Google is the one who put up the money
for it. Well, they got the fingers into everything nowadays, so that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, the United Federation of Google. Hey!
So is this the Google egg?
It's a Google egg. What did I just start? So Dr. Crusher, she's back! She's back! What do you guys think of Dr. Crusher being back?
Oh, before we move on, I just wanted to say, he says there's no cracks in the armor on the egg.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's going to throw this thing into a stellar debris storm, yet he's worried about it getting thrown around a little bit on the starship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Because it didn't seem to move at all, but hey, that's okay.
Yeah.
No worries.
And actually, one other thing before we move on to Dr. Crusher, which is that there's a bit after... You know, things have been shaken and stuff, and I think it's Picard. He asks about to explain it. Computer, explain the malfunction, and then the computer responds, saying, the computer responds effectively saying, "I don't know." And I quite like the fact that the computer just refused to acknowledge it. Sometimes, whenever you have something I don't like about Star Trek is when the computer seems to know the answer, but you have to be cryptic in asking the computer to volunteer the information. So you'll do things like, computer, analyze the data. And then, okay, analyze harder, do it better. And apparently, you know, the computer never knew that you wanted it done correctly. So I like the way that, you know, the computer's broken. It's not doing something correct. When you ask, why aren't you doing it correctly? It says, What are you talking about? I am doing it correctly. So that was, I quite like that.
Yeah, diagnostic. Oh, diagnostic's fine, guys. Well, maybe it's something wrong with you. Okay, Dr. Crusher, she's back. Do you think obviously the fans wanted Dr. Crusher back, right? Yeah. Is that the gossip?
There was various reasons why you left. It was the fans, but the fans wanted her back.
Okay.
And there was also a change in the production people, so they wanted her back as well.
Do you agree with it, or do you think they should have just brought on a whole new face?
Well, it depends on what story you believe in the reason why she left in the first place. The one story is she left because she thought that basically her character wasn't amounting to anything apart from the love interest for Picard. Mm-hmm. Then there's the other story that she fell out with the producers. And then there's the other story that she basically was being a bit of a diva. So it depends what story you believe. Mm. Bearing in mind that Crosby left for similar reasons because she thought her character wasn't going anywhere. So I'm leaning more towards that than anything else. The mistake they made with Pulaski was to try to make a female McCoy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to work because McCoy is McCoy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think they realized that early in season two and they started to change her character as she went on, and she did get better. But unfortunately, wasn't enough.
At least they never put her down a lift shaft.
I still think they should have. It would have been perfect. You know, Picard, I'm just not going to talk about this any further. No! Bang. But, you know, could they gotten her? I mean, as soon as she fell, I don't think the transporter could have gotten her fast enough before she hit the first bulkhead.
No. Yeah. Well, O'Brien would have been off duty then anyway.
Yeah, right. Yes. He was trying to... He was just meeting Keiko.
Yeah.
Yeah. Poor guy. He doesn't know what hell he's going to go through.
I'm sorry for him. But hey, you'll get to that when you do Data's Day.
Oh, I'll have much to say before we get to Data's Day. Okay. So, Dr. Crusher's back. She's taking care of Dr. Stubbs. Let's talk about Dr. Crusher. She went on to head of Starfleet Medical. And now she's back. Mm. We don't know why, so it's our job to set it right. Why is Dr. Crusher back? What happened at Starfleet Medical?
She's back because she missed her husband and her son. I mean, she missed Picard and Wesley.
Okay, so you mean she missed Wesley and his father?
Yes. That's why she's back.
Because it doesn't seem like Wesley's very happy of her being back.
No, she does. She does address it in other episodes. She basically says that she missed the ship, and the aspects of being on a ship as opposed to being in a starbase. That's she does mention it again in other episodes. So,
okay.
Yeah, it's like the only way to look at it is like when Spock says to Kirk, "Being a starship captain is your first and best destiny."
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she thought being a ship's doctor was where she should be rather than running administration, basically.
So she didn't kill an admiral somewhere and they said, you are just definitely not suited for this job.
Well, maybe there was a bit concerned because enough of the crew weren't dying.
Mm.
So they needed to get back on board to do some euthanasia.
Hmm. Okay. Well, it's too bad she didn't consult Pulaski in her memory wiping thing, as we'll find out in a couple episodes.
Well, Wesley doesn't like heights. So shouting down a lift shaft wouldn't have worked.
Hmm? Say that again, please.
She doesn't like heights. So shouting down a lift shaft to Pulaski wouldn't have worked.
Oh, no. No, but still. She didn't. Yeah, she didn't know that the lift wasn't
when
there.
When they do the rock climbing thing, she says she doesn't like heights.
Oh, my goodness. Hey, I just thought of something. Right here in this episode, would have been the perfect time to kill off Pulaski. And then we had to get Crusher back because all of the malfunctions that this thing, these nanites caused on the ship, the turbo lift was one of them. The turbo lift doors open, she got on and boom, she went down. That's a missed opportunity.
No. The real missed opportunity here is that obviously, you know, this is spoiling the episode a little bit. Eventually, Data becomes, you know, he interfaces in with the nanites. Whilst in that state, Data murders Pulaski in cold blood, and he pretends that it was the nanites that told him to do it. Mm-hmm. So it's like getting that. It's getting back from West Silence's lease.
That's a lot better. I do like that.
Okay.
And how so long slightly had different this? Show, though.
Yeah. I don't think it would have gone out on primetime TV, though, but there you
Well, okay. I'm going to type in a thing here.
There you go. We've come up with two alternative ways to get rid of Pulaski.
Yeah.
Or you could tie them together and Data kills her and then throws her down the lift shaft to hide the body.
I was just thinking, the way we're talking now reminds me of the way we killed off Wesley Crusher.
Oh, that was funny.
We killed off Wesley Crusher on episode 61 of the Lou Trek Show. It was just a couple hundred different ways. Everything from a shotgun blast to the face to, a phaser set on minimal, repeatedly hitting him until he finally dies. It was just a bunch of stuff we came up with. And believe it or not, I actually sent a message to Will Wheaton, you know, figuring that he might be interested in hearing that. And I never heard anything back. So... You know,
he's doing a Big Bang Theory now. He's a bit busy.
Yeah, that is. Yeah. What? He comes on like once a year, once or twice. But when he comes on, they're fun. So, but anyway, okay, let's go ahead and continue on. So you don't think that she got into some sex scandal at Starfleet Medical with an admiral and had to leave? Okay.
Now, Lou, I'm going to call you out on this blatant sexism here. Because when, you know, when Worf joins Deep Space Nine, I don't think you're going to say, why is he in Deep Space Nine? Has he gone into a sex scandal whilst on the Enterprise?
Well, actually, he did. He defiled Deanna Troi.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why he's running away from
her? I mean, come on, let's be honest. Even when she turns into a fish, he still wants her.
Yes, he defiled her. The poor woman. So, no, okay. But another thing I didn't mention to you, and I could leave it to myself, but that admiral was a woman. So we're going to stop there. Okay. Dr. Crusher is just so...
Went from a PG to an R.
Yeah, right. Yes. And she's going to deal with this issue again, you know, when we see some trills. Dr. Crusher is happy to be back, except for that pesky food slot. Food slot. Does she mean replicator?
Yeah, has anyone referred to these as food slots ever in the past, and will they ever again?
Only yes. This episode. I don't remember hearing food slot in a future episode.
In TOS, they refer to them as food slots.
Oh, yes, they do, because that's what they were. Yeah. But they weren't really replicators in TOS.
No, not in TOS. They weren't replicators as such.
Right. So... Here we see the food slot, and actually it's over bubbling some kind of reddish liquid. So actually it's a drink slot, not a food slot. But can't she use that slot to replicate anything else? Can she replicate medicines? Hyposprays?
I don't know. I think, no, because there's industrial replicators that do... different type of things. So she's probably got two different replicators in there. But the other thing that makes me laugh with is yet again, it's the computer saying, there ain't nothing wrong with that.
No, you know, right.
Fix the food slot. It's fine. What do you want about?
What's wrong? Isn't this what you want? Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that, because my next point is that even Captain Picard is on the food slot kick. And in fact, I remember in DS9, Commander Eddington stole the industrial food slot for the Maquis. And Sisko hunted him down for those food slots.
Can we stop saying food slots?
But that's what it is. They're food slots.
Yeah.
Food slot.
Eddington just wanted to make really big sandwiches.
I can't imagine. Okay, here's the deal. At Starbase Medical, that's what they call them. So she had a whole year of calling them food slots. But then when she's in Riker or Picard, then when she's in Picard's ready room and he says, "I want a computer that's fixed so to do Dr. Stubbs' experiment." Oh, and the food slots in sick bay. So even Picard does a food slot. Okay. Anyway, here we go. Jean-Luc, how would you feel if you were headlong into puberty and your mother came back to run your life again? No, wait, that's not what she says. Something like that, though, right?
Well, in fairness, Picard's mum is dead, though, at this point, right? So it would be more unusual for Picard. But I quite like this little chat with Crusher and Picard. I think it's one slight problem that I have with this episode is that despite there being a Crusher family reunion, I think that there's a little bit too much focus on Wesley, and we see a lot of the stuff through Wesley's eyes. Dr. Crusher's only in the background, and I think that the one or two scenes that she has, you know, I think once with Picard and once with Guinan, it allows the writer to put a little bit more, you know, a little bit, develop the character of Dr. Crusher a little bit more. And I don't particularly like where that appeared to be going with this, you know, just stroppy teenager Wesley. Mm-hmm. But I like the, you know, I think the interactions between Picard and Crusher are perfectly reasonable and, you know, are well placed.
You think? I didn't.
Okay.
Because I'm just thinking, how much information do you think Picard really has he ever been in love?
Okay, well, I have this, right? Because they say, "Well, Picard, has he ever been in love?" And then Picard goes, "Well, there was that episode with that shapeshifter, but we don't talk about it anymore. No. Not since Lou and James can't agree on its pronunciation."
I would love it if Picard said that.
"Not since Lou and James can't agree on its pronunciation."
No, not since they were pretty strict on what happened.
But the other thing that gets me is, with that little conversation, is now, us three, here now, we're talking on Skype, right? Lou's in America, we're in England, okay? You're telling me that in the future she never did, like, space Skype?
No, right. They just completely stayed away from each other.
For a whole year.
For a whole year. That's what it seems like. Because she missed how many inches of him?
Two.
2 inches.
2 inches, yeah.
He's a man now.
Yeah. So for the whole year, she never talked to her son at all. Just emailed him.
No. "Mom, this girl is awesome. Mom, this girl is a shapeshifter. How awesome is that? Mom, I lost her." I mean, I don't get how Picard, you know, what information could he really have to give about her own son?
Exactly. And he's the captain of a Federation Galaxy-class starship with 1,000 people on board.
Yeah.
You know? And a malfunctioning food slot.
Malfunctioning. But he does give an answer. I mean, the only answer he can give, he's becoming a great officer. He's done a lot of good on the ship. They haven't figured out the nanite problem yet.
He's nearly destroyed it 15 times and then saved it.
He saved it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, just before you move on, I just looked at they are called food synthesizer in TOS.
Food
synthesizer. So they're not even called food slots in TOS.
It just seemed to me what the food slots in TOS were was the card actually is...
Yeah, it was a food synthesizer in TOS, the TV show. It was in the TOS novels, they call them food slots.
Okay.
I was always under the impression in TOS they were basically vending machines.
That's what I was going to say. They're pre-made food that's sitting in a vending machine, and the card tells which slot to open up and pull that product out.
That's what I always got that as well. Either that or there was actually a chef behind the slot who handed
you the
food.
Well, they did have a chef. We know they had chefs in TOS because they actually go to the kitchen on the ship in the movies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So they did have chefs. So obviously, you know, chef cooked the food and put it on a tray and... It was like on a conveyor. Maybe it's like a sushi bar. It's on one of them conveyor belts.
Okay, so while we're on this, one of the very few bad things about Undiscovered Country is that when you phaser a guy preparing food. Why on earth did you still get like the cake mix left after the bowl has evaporated?
And it didn't go bump.
It petrifies it.
Yeah, it didn't. I mean, if nothing else, the cake should have been cooked.
So in that logic, if you hit one of us with that phaser, our clothes would disappear.
If it was a light sponge, it might have been cooked because it was the right color.
It sat there in its whole form. It didn't just plop down.
No, but the worst thing about that is the actual whisk is half out of the mixture.
Yeah, this
with a bit of the mixture on it.
Yeah,
as if it's suspended in midair by the mixture.
I wonder if it's dough.
God, no, I don't know.
But you're right. There you go. I hadn't thought of that ever. Okay, so caution, variable gravity. You guys know what I'm talking about? Did anybody pick up on that? Caution, variable gravity.
I missed that. When did
that? Yeah, I missed that.
It's in the shuttle bay. So you see the two guys in the control room.
Oh, the warning sign.
Yeah,
sure.
The guys up in the control room are very busy doing nothing, even walking around while Wesley and Stubbs are looking at the egg to see if there's any problems with the probe. And on the wall under the control room is a sign that says, caution, variable gravity. So I'm thinking that deserves some explanation. I mean, as you're walking along, all of a sudden gravity is gone and then you get to a spot.
It's when they drop the force field.
They turn off the artificial gravity so that you can escape the ship easier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you can fly in and out.
Mm. Okay, because I was thinking that at different spots, gravity is a little lighter here and a little heavier.
No, it's not like an Enterprise when you got the sweet spot.
Yeah. Okay. All right, well, we already talked about the Wonder Kid, or the Wunderkind.
Wonder Kid.
Yeah. It's German for clueless. Okay, there we see. Now, if Dr. Stubbs was called a Wonder Kid, what were we called when we were kids?
I was called plenty of things, but none of them you can say on air.
Mm. Yeah. You fat little bastard. I'm sorry. I should have just taken your cue and said nothing on air. I think James just fell. Did you hear that?
It wasn't on my side at all.
Oh, I thought maybe your head hit the desk or something.
No, it didn't.
We're already in the R ratings.
I guess so. Okay, so as Dr. Stubbs is explaining to Wesley all the incredible dynamics of himself, we jumped the red alert. Why? Because the sensors indicated the approach of a Borg vessel, but they don't see anything. The invisible Borg are firing energy weapons, which is all a computer glitch. Let's see. The ship's rocking. Doors are opening and closing. The computer's playing chess. Something's definitely wrong. And the only thing I'm thinking of that I saw was questionable. When Geordi says he better get back to engineering, the exact same second he says that, the engineering station on the bridge goes dark. So I'm thinking, what?
Because as he walks away from it, it turns off.
Yes, well, I mean, it didn't turn off until he said, I think I better go to engineering. Poof. What if Picard had said, no, you stay here? Do you think it would turn right back on? Or?
Yeah, it would have turned back on, yeah.
Oh, he's not going anywhere. Okay, yeah. Go ahead, Doc.
So there's a reference in this episode that apparently there's no, no system-wide failure on a starship for 80 years or something crazy like that.
Yeah, 79 years.
So we saw it last season with the Yamato. That blew up because of a system-wide failure. I mean, where's the mystery here? It's happened before. It's happening again, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I know that the Yamato was eventually cured by a computer virus from an ancient civilization, but I still think it qualifies as system-wide failure.
Maybe he means a system-wide failure due to bad manufacturing as opposed to an infection or something.
But then it's not really that's not the threat this week either, right? It's nanites that are the threat.
Yeah, but I don't know about the nanites yet.
But to me it sounds like a very like an insurance-y term, right? It's like, we'll protect you against everything, all system-wide failures. oh, no, no, not anything that is caused by a virus from an ancient civilization. That's not valid.
Get
and
it
also,
in
nanite print. Infection. Nanite infection also is in the small print as well.
Yeah. Exemptions to this contract include Iconian death rays, nanites.
Yeah, but nanites would not originally have ever done this kind of problem. It's because they were increased nanites. Yeah, right. So, yeah, okay. Conference. Dr. Stubbs wants to know what's going on. And we find out here that he'd rather die than watch this, you know, lose a chance to do this experiment. Of course, he doesn't speak for the rest of the crew. But do you think maybe he might speak for some of the crew?
No.
1,040 people aboard the Enterprise and 1,039 would rather not die for this experiment.
To be honest, I think he's Dr. Stubbs' motivation for making this experiment work is not just the fact that it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I think, from what he says earlier, I think it's also to prove his mother wrong. So he'd rather have died and go back and face his mother ranting at him.
So what, I mean, obviously the experiment is a success. And one of the things I'm not going to do on the show anymore is ever use the word spoiler alert. We know what's going on. There's nothing spoiled here.
They are quite a few decades old.
Yeah, let's assume that if you're listening to this, you already know what's going on. So after this is over, it was a success. What do you think he's going to do now? His whole life was to this moment. I guess read the data?
Yeah, the amount of data that was flooding in would take years to go through.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look at Hubble.
Yeah.
You know, the data they got from Hubble, it took them years to go through all the pictures.
Mm. Okay.
No, absolutely. And you know, slightly more modern, if you look at, you know, the particle accelerator they recently built at CERN with the Large Hadron Collider, right? There's all of the effort in order to get to the point where they can run the experiment, which I take away from this, the reason why they need this to happen when the explosion occurs is because effectively he's running an experiment. After the experiment has been run, he's got probably decades worth of data to go through and to write up and to confirm theories, to revisit other stuff. And so he's going to be busy for quite a while.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. What did you think of this line?
Dr. Stubbs, I know how much this means to you.
My dear counselor, no insult intended, but please turn off your beam into my soul. I will share the feelings I wish to share. Well, if we do not leave in time, so be it. It's one sure way into the record books, eh?
But I just love that line, turn off Troy.
But this is one of the things that's always interested me about Next Gen, because Next Gen went down the telepath and the empath routes on a big scale. And I always couldn't help thinking that there should be some sort of protocol whereby telepathic and empathic species don't scan non-telepathic and non-empathic species without their permission. Because the ramifications of a telepath or an empath knowing what you're thinking, what you're doing, and stuff like that are unbelievable.
Yeah, but they can't stop her. She can't even stop herself. But she can only sense emotion. Now you bring Loxana on, she can't help it.
Yeah, but if you take Loxana in, Loxana isn't always using her mind to communicate. Sometimes she uses her mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously she can turn her telepathy off and on.
Mm-hmm.
So there's got to be some level of control with her empathy.
Yeah, but I guess if you were to say, you know, don't do this, don't turn this knob ever. Obviously, there's a difference between a guy who can choose to turn that knob and one who that knob just turns for him anyway. That was a bad example, but I don't think there's
I know what you mean. Don't press the red flashing light.
Yeah, there's no way she can stop.
How many people will press the red flashing light because you tell them not to?
Well, there's a little self-control. I mean, I can not press the red light because obviously if I do, there's going to be some consequences. But to tell an empath, don't beam into other people unless you ask for permission, that the way is, number one, you can't control, you can't govern that. There's no way to know, hey, she's beaming into my soul. I can feel it. So, and she can't really help it. It's comes as natural as breathing air. She's sensing things.
Yeah, but if interpreting the data is a choice.
Yeah, that's true. She could ignore, you know, and walking along the corridor and, you know, hear. How many times did she approach Riker's door and she didn't have to knock to know that she better not go in? There's something.
Probably, you know, every night.
Well, yeah. And was that just from the noises she heard from the room?
Yeah. Well, she couldn't hear the noises. It's just the mental
image.
What's
Commander Riker doing? Oh, he's rearranging furniture.
Yeah. Yes, I can hear him in my thoughts, you know. And the reason why she came down is because he was thinking of her at the time she was with. He was with her, another person. So, wonder what he's thinking about me for. Let's go find out. Oh, nope, I'm not going in there. That's got to happen a lot.
Yeah. Imagine if you was a non-telepath and you was dating a telepath.
Oh, man,
you wouldn't get away with anything.
Oh, hell no. God, no. Even if it's just emotions thing, she can sense everything.
Yeah. What were you doing last night? Oh, I was just watching the football.
Liar.
Want to try that again?
Yeah. Try it again. It's like, I'll tell you, it's funny. It's a complete tangent, but that's what I do for a living. I catch shoplifters. And I've got video. Every time I catch a shoplifter, I've got them at least on one camera doing what it is that I'm saying that they're doing. And the way our camera system is set up, I can get 2, 3, and even 4 cameras on the person at the same time. And they will go into this and, I didn't do anything. And, you know, and then when they hear me give my detail to the police, well, he did this. He walked over here. He picked this up. He went to this area. You could see the look on their face like, ah, crap. Yeah. They know I got them. So, I mean, obviously, all I have to do is say, are you sure about that? Are you sure? Okay, so you said you picked this up and that you walked around and you set it down. Are you sure about that? Are you sure about that? And that's generally the way they end up going, all right, I did it. So, I wouldn't have to say anything. She would just pull it out. And we're still talking about Riker, by the way. Pull it out. Okay. Wesley visits. That's an R now. It's an R now. Wesley visits engineering and realizes this experiment has something to do with the problem. Are you guys surprised that Wesley didn't stumble on it a little bit faster?
Not surprised he didn't stumble on it a little bit faster, but I am surprised that once he recognized what it was, he didn't think, oh, I better tell someone in case we suddenly plunge into the sun again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Instead, he sneaks around 10 forward, setting nanite traps.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of which, did you notice how far apart he was putting the nanite traps, about 6 to 8 feet?
Mm-hmm.
If he did that over the entire ship, he'd have to put thousands.
Thousands, yes. If the nanites are in the... Oh, go ahead.
So how large are the nanites, right? We're talking about, you know, wow, several atoms across. Yeah. You think you need a trap? To me, it makes no sense, right? So whatever physical object you can build, so he's got this like plastic box thing, it's going to probably be the little ridge that you're going to have in order to enter into the box is probably going to be a billion times larger than the nanite itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's just ridiculous in terms of scale of what you're looking for.
It's also ridiculous just assuming that the nanites are running around the carpet.
Well, no, I think what that was, that was bait. That's the same thing as why we put peanut butter on a mouse trap. It smells it, and it knew that there is some computer core in this box. So all I need to do is just go into it, because he does catch some nanites. That's how he knows exactly what happened.
Which goes back to what James did then. How did it get over the lip into the box?
Right. Where did it go from the box that it was in the beginning, and where did it go to get into the computer? I don't know, but... Yeah, anyway, all because his experiment was to pimp 2 nanites together and see how they work in tandem.
Yeah, he was doing nanite porn.
Yes. He wanted to see what can happen. Yeah.
So what did he exactly mean by that? I didn't quite understand. I didn't understand exactly what he was suggesting. You know, was his experiment that instead of using 1 nanite, he used 2? Or was
no,
he
his
actually
experiment
changing?
Was, his experiment was to have 2 nanites work together, which had never been done before.
So is this quote-unquote work together in the way that male nanites and female nanites do?
I don't know. We might as well go with that. We've done everything else in this episode.
But no, that's not what it means.
Yeah, but that was his experiment, to see what would happen if 2 nanites in quotation marks, worked together. Say, and we all know what happened when they did work together. They were fruitful and multiplied.
Yes, that is true. That's exactly what they did. They realized that they could replicate themselves and become even better. So I guess by the time we get to Voyager, when, you know, the doctor is pumping somebody with 40,000 nanites, they work together. Okay, so Guinan's doctor friend, Frankenstein.
Don't the Borg assimilate by using nanites?
Yes.
I mean, yeah, I think something that is going to come up with this episode, I think realistically this technology gets jettisoned, as far as I'm aware, and then the next time it comes up is in the Borg, and it's clearly evil technology that only an evil mastermind would ever have available to it.
The stuff
that Dr. Crusher suggests, like, oh, no, we go inside your internal organ and then we do some repair and then we replace your arm with a spinny disc.
Oh, my God, we've just solved where the Borg come from.
It was Crusher met at Starfleet Medical, and that's why
they put him on that planet to evolve. That's where the Borg come from. These nanites are the Borg.
Well, I don't know about that, because obviously by this time, because
the Borg are in the Delta Quadrant.
Yeah, Annika Hansen has already been assimilated. So, but you stumbled onto something that I have in my notes here about how, you know, she has to tell Dr. Stubbs that these nanites are not working with the collective intelligence, operating together, teaching each other new skills. And I thought, I wonder if this is the point where the light bulb went on in somebody's head about how we're going to construct the Borg and their collective consciousness.
Yeah, that is interesting. And like James says, because they jettisoned this and then made it, you know, nanites are evil.
Well, or, you know, a Borg ship invaded the nanite homeworld.
Which would also explain how the Borg regenerate the ships, because the nanites would be fixing it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, I mean, maybe that was the... Okay, Data Logan, you had talked one time about the first assimilation. I think that's what it could have been. They came into contact with the nanite homeworld, and it taught them... No, it didn't, because, again, Annika Hansen was Delta already... Quadrant. Yeah, it happened in the Delta... Never mind. So we're still in a quandary about the first Borg assimilation, why it occurred and when.
Well, in First Contact, the Queen says that we used to be like you.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So but at some point, maybe they started adding cybernetic parts to them, and it just went from there.
The thing about the Queen, though, is that is she referring to the Borg as a species or as like herself as an individual that was assimilated?
Well, if you think about her designation, she's not species one.
Mm.
No, you're right, she's not.
No.
So
I've always imagined this as being, you know, whenever I've thought in my mind's eye about how they would ever portray the Borg, I've always assumed that there was, you know, a scientist sitting there in a lab somewhere doing some stuff, working on things, and then eventually there was an experiment gone wrong that nabbed him, and, you know, he effectively created the Borg.
If you read William Shatner's books, Star Trek books, in one of William Shatner's books, and I'm sure it's been done in another book. Do you remember in Star Trek The Motion Picture, Spock says a planet of living machines.
Yeah.
William Shatner in his books, and some other authors in their books, have said that the planet that V'ger came from was the Borg homeworld. In its, like, infancy.
Hmm. So V'ger is a reason of the Borg?
No, well, the premise they put forward in the books is that when the robot machine planet that V'ger fell into, and who repaired it and sent it back, that was the primeval Borg. Because obviously V'ger took, like, you know, quite a long time to get back to Earth, and over that time the primeval Borg evolved into the Borg and started assimilating.
Fascinating. Okay, well, it's good enough there is any. Okay, so let's see. We're going to try to get that experiment running again. But this time the doors won't respond and the computer feels like Celebrating with Some Stars and Stripes by Philip Sousa. You guys familiar with Stars and Stripes? Of course you are.
Nah.
No.
Never heard of it.
Never heard of it. How about that?
I don't understand why, when they turn it on, it has to be things like, you know, Stars and Stripes. You know, can't they put some Bohemian Rhapsody on or something? Would have been more.
Is this a real French life?
Because it's French. So why wasn't it the French one?
Mm. Mm. Maybe it's an American ship.
Well, obviously. Well, can I? Riker's Canadian.
Mm. Yeah. He's not. He's Alaskan.
No, I mean the actor.
Jonathan Frakes.
Right. Yes.
Yeah, Canadian.
No. Is he?
No.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Jonathan Frakes or William Riker? What are we talking about?
No, William Riker's from Alaska.
Yeah.
Alaska.
But Frakes is Canadian.
Is Frakes Canadian?
Oh.
Frakes isn't Canadian.
That.
Okay, I hear Memory Alpha.
I hear Memory Alpha. Yeah.
But the interesting thing, I mean, not interesting, I noticed that the way that Picard gets around the fact that there's some music playing.
No, he's born in Pennsylvania.
Mm, okay.
So the way that Picard gets around the fact that effectively someone's iPod on the bridge is a little bit too loud is that he demands that he shut off all power to the bridge, which I assume includes life support and the inertial dampness and the artificial gravity and everything. I found that a bit extreme.
Well, they may have had a few extra minutes left of breathing air.
Yeah, no, I just had an image of Picard saying, turn off all power to the bridge, floating up to the ceiling and going, no, put it back on.
Yeah, just pull the plug. I mean, there's got to be plugs to the speakers. Just, you know, pull the plug. Okay, so the eggs at Stub laid. I like this little exchange. In fact, I'm going to put it right here.
The egg that Stubbs laid. No one will say that. Nobody will say anything at all, Wesley. We will not even be mentioned. I could live with failure. Well, maybe not. But never even to try to miss your one chance at bat. Do you know baseball?
Yes, my father taught it to me when I was young.
Once, centuries ago, it was the beloved national pastime of the Americas, Wesley. Abandoned by a society that prized fast food and faster games. Lost to impatience. But I have seen the great players make the great plays.
Do you recreate them on a holodeck?
No. In here. With the knowledge of statistics, runs, hits, and errors, times at bat, box scores. Men like us do not need holodecks, Wesley. I have played seasons in my mind. It was my reward to myself for patience, knowing my turn would come. Call your shot. Point to a star. One great blast and the crowd rises. A brand new era in astrophysics. Postponed 196 years on account of rain.
So, the part that I like to pick about on that is men like us do not need holodecks, Wesley. And I'm thinking, yeah, sure. Wesley doesn't use holodecks. Yeah.
He breaks them.
Yeah, he breaks them. But, I mean, we all know that Wesley uses holodecks. For various reasons.
Yeah, for snowball fights.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. For snowball fights. Hmm. He borrowed the particular program I got in my head from Geordi.
Now, as an Englishman on this podcast, I am going to have to just point out to the Americans out there that baseball is just a slow version of cricket. And this idea that baseball itself is slow, baseball has already lost anything that you might consider to be a legitimate cause of a beautiful game when it is played over, what, a single day? Or how is baseball played? It's just a lame, tame version of cricket.
I always thought baseball was akin to rounders.
Yeah, which is a child's version of cricket.
Okay, send your emails to...
Yeah, send it to them, because I don't know what they're talking about, to be honest.
Yeah.
Not a clue. Obviously, it's an American pastime. I mean, my daughter played softball.
Although on DS9, Cisco is an avid baseball fan.
Yes. But nobody else knows it.
No.
Except for one or two people that just happened to come on the station. What? You like baseball?
Oh, and a Vulcan.
And it just so happened to be Cassidy Yates. The woman of his dreams and my nightmares. Just so happens to her brother plays this. Oh, I don't know. This game. Baseball, I think it is? Baseball? So, whatever. I mean, that's another thing. Why wouldn't Cisco know about baseball teams being formed in Earth? Hey, wait. Wrong podcast. Let's come back to TNG. Okay, so by the time... Here's another thing. Do you guys think this makes sense? By the time Picard and Riker notice a change in the ready room environment, it's already enveloped the bridge. But no one thought to inform the captain. I mean, these guys are just sitting at their chairs choking
to death.
And they're continuing to work. Nobody's running out. Even Ensign Joy didn't run out of the room.
No, and you would assume that, like, any military ship, they would practice, like, for fires and stuff like that.
Yeah, they would. You would. And they're going to go somewhere.
No one thought, let's walk to the back of the bridge and press the vent button.
No. Right. Captain... Captain, could you come out here? There's a problem. We're joking. And it's nitrogen oxide, toxic levels. Is that the same as nitrous oxide?
Oh, I thought they did reference. I thought they said nitrous oxide.
No, they said nitrogen oxide. And that's why I have it in my notes. Nitrogen oxide. If it's the same as nitrous oxide, you mean the laughing gas that the dentist gives you to pull a tooth? How's that toxic? Laugh yourself to death? They were choking. They weren't laughing to death, you know. This is funny. Because as soon as Riker pressed those couple buttons, that's another thing. Should the environment have immediately went to 100% oxygen or whatever they have?
No, 100% oxygen will kill you.
Well, okay, that's true. Whatever their normal air breathing air is, it changed immediately to that. And then, as soon as it changed, not one person coughed again. It's still in your lungs.
Lou, I'm proud of you. These are extremely valid points, akin to the idea of the rate of growth being reduced to zero. You're absolutely on the money on this.
Good. I feel good today. Okay. So did Dr. Stubbs really hit on Deanna?
Very, very badly.
Oh, my goodness. I will show you Newt Page Dell and your body that you've never seen before. Something like that. But his work is so, you know, his attitude is so studied, so practiced. It is, isn't it?
It's,
Now, can I...
Comparing him on that, this woman's been hit on by Riker, who's professional. Stubbs' attempts was painful.
Yes, it was. It was.
Now, I think we've gone past, by the way, the bit where people have kind of had the discussion about the nanites and how now they seem to be, you know, the nanites have infested the ship and such. And I have to say, I think that as a scientist, I don't buy Dr. Stubbs's kind of resistance, because he puts out a lot of lines there saying, you know, how could possibly they evolve? And I think he comes across a little bit too closed-minded. For my mind, as a dude who is sitting there working on the kind of, you know, cutting edge of science, so I don't know what anyone else.
Did you not put some of it down to his obsession with his project, though?
Yeah, but the ship is in distress. You know, we're on the cutting edge of dying here, and the solution is simple. Call an exterminator. I don't know. I kind of agree with them on this. We're taking too much time to try and communicate with these things when we could just finish this.
Well, the other glaringly obvious thing that goes through this entire episode that no one picks up on is he keeps saying they are just machines. Mm-hmm. Data is a machine.
Right. And it's addressed like that. You know, you're talking to a machine right now. Well, it's a little bit different, though. If he was trying to kill us all, then I would exterminate him, too. So, what I was going to think, what do we think of the notion of the nanites being able to communicate? How is that possible? I mean, if they were just one nanite short, could they still talk?
Well, this goes back to them evolving with each generation. I mean, how fast are they reproducing generations? I mean, the thing that I had in my head while I was watching this is Terminator, Cyberdyne Systems. And he says, the Terminator says, Cyberdyne's Skynet went live and evolved at a geometric rate. I mean, what is a geometric rate of evolution?
So do you want an answer to that?
Yeah, go on.
Go for it.
Okay, so, I mean, so geometric is just something that is going up by a certain certain constant ratio. So what... In fact, geometric in this case is very going to be very similar to exponential. So you're just going to be taking, you know, 1 and then multiplying it by 2, then multiply by 2 again and multiply by 2 again. So it just is, it's kind of growth that is, that gets faster the longer you've been along. I mean, so example would be when they talk of, you know, things like the number of transistors you can have on a circuit board doubling every 10 years or so. Although then they use the term geometric rate of evolution. I mean, rate of evolution. I don't know if that's anything that is specifically well defined.
So the other thing we see is we know they started off with 2. When they blow up the isolinear chip and they're feeding on in Riker's eyes, it's like candy to them. When they replicate or reproduce, they double. So, bearing in mind how long this has been going on for, how many evolutions would it take for them to go from non-thinking to, like Lou said, capable of speech or understanding speech? Because, as we know from our own planet, there's an awful lot of animals on this planet, but very few of them actually use communication in a form like dolphins and humans and stuff like that.
Who do you think the ship's snitch is? You know, Dr. Stubbs is playing a game of baseball in his mind when all of a sudden he's attacked by his food slot. Food slot! I wanted to say replicator, but I knew I'd be wrong. Somebody told the nanites about him, because we passed that part. Let's go back. Dr. Stubbs irradiates a computer core, I guess it is, and kills all the nanites in the upper computer core. So they get back at him.
I don't think it'd have to be a snitch, though, because if they're in the ship's system, so they would have access to the sensors.
Yeah, so they know who it was that attacked him.
Yeah, and they would be able to find him.
So do you think that was the computer core that Wesley and Data and LaForge was in? Or is that just maybe a computer room with little station and a bunch of storage?
Well, they actually say a computer core processor, so it's either the core or one of the cores.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they've got a backup.
So why weren't they wearing, like, clean suits?
Don't have to in the future.
Oh, don't have to. They just...
No, don't have to in the future, no.
Okay. No. They just get hit by the blast of air that cleans them off.
When you walk through the door, there's a thing over the door that blasts downwards and cleans you.
Oh, got it. Okay. So Data is not only able to communicate with the nanites by using ones and zeros, they can also let them take control of his body to talk. Okay, let's assume that there's a valid reason why Data is letting the nanites in there. Why does his voice change?
Well, not just that. Before we even get to the voice change, is Data is a highly sophisticated computer machine with a positronic matrix. Yet these nanites manage to work out how he works, how his matrix works, understand language, and take over him in, 3 seconds?
Yes. And stare down Dr. Stubbs, by the way. So, you think Brent was reading this script and thought, I'm going to have to be inflective here? Or is this just some bad acting?
We know who you are.
Doesn't
this just also apply to masks when he ends up?
I was just going to say about masks.
So it's the same thing, right? I think it's an extremely valid point. I've never considered it. It also happens even in The Passenger, right? When Bashir gets
steal my thunder.
You know, something in the back of his head, and the murderer comes, and when he's in murdering territory, he uses a slightly different voice. Not quite completely different, but just slightly different. It's nonsense. Yeah.
Ray O. Vantica.
Yeah, in another episode, spoilers, when they get taken over by the prisoners, they keep the voices.
Yes.
Yeah, but O'Brien's a little bit ruder, right?
Yeah, the manner.
Get over here.
Yeah, you know, Deanna's a prize bee, but basically the voice is.
The Deanna's voice changes, right? She goes from her "I'm sensing things" to her pretty much her Cockney accent in that episode.
Her proper accent comes out a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Although Keiko was able to control her voice when the Paw Wraiths took over her.
Yeah, well, that was the only time Keiko was actually interesting. But there you go.
I was going to say, that's the only time I actually liked Keiko.
Yeah.
And he could have killed her.
When possessed by the devil.
Yes. Yeah. He could have killed her.
The only time you actually want to watch Keiko is when she's not Keiko.
Right. Right. I mean, you know, we get her again in Rascals. That's another Keiko moment. Oh, I cannot wait to get to Rascals. That's just strange in all forms. But anyway, yeah. So you're talking about
the little girl who plays Garden is brilliant.
Oh, that's excellent. No, they are good. And jumping on the bed.
How did the transporter shrink the hat?
James, save it for when you get there.
Yeah, we're gonna have to wait. We're gonna have to wait. Because we're gonna have to discuss the moment where Miles O'Brien is in the bedroom with Keiko, and you know she's snuggling up to him, and there's some strange moments that
it was Neelix and Kes all over again.
Mm-hmm. Yes, except for Kes looked like an adult. You're a little girl. Anyway,
although fairness to Miles, he does say no, I can't do this, and gets out.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we know. We're definitely going
to
have
jumping back to this one.
Yeah, we're going to have some conversation. So there's a truce. It's been made. The war is over. And the experiment was a glowing success. I mean, all over the bridge, that is. And and Dr. Stubbs has used his influence to have planet Cavus Alpha 4 designated the new home of the nanite civilization. I don't know why, but every time I hear that line, I just burst out laughing, just like I did. I can't help but I don't know why. the new home of the nanite civilization. What do you guys think of that one? We discussed that, didn't we?
The thing is, though, is the nanites. So if anyone else went there, would they know they were there?
Say that again. What?
They're a nanite civilization.
Yes.
So if another civilization went there, would they know they were there?
Don't know.
Because the Federation has dubbed it the home of the nanite civilization. That doesn't mean any other civilization knows that.
No.
You know, if they're outside the Federation.
I'm sure the Packlids would try to steal some of their technology.
God. You make us go.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, okay, now we are down to the last bit of Guinan, who has lots of children, and she's talking with Dr. Crusher. You know, what do I do about this child of mine? And in walks this child of hers with a pretty good-looking girl. How in the hell did that happen? Any comments on how Wesley got that cute of a girl to go with him?
She's a hologram.
But there's no holographic technology in 10-4 that we know of.
She's an evolved nanite.
So you can't get away. Sense. You can't get away with that because then the doctor would have been had better holographic.
Well, the other problem with this is he also says to the doctor that most of my free time is spent with studying.
Yes. So he created her.
He grew her in a petri dish.
Ah.
Maybe she sees new science experiments. He's going to do mating rituals.
Right. That's possible. I did want to ask one question that I forgot to ask a little bit back. Guinan brings up this Dr. Frankenstein as if it was a real person.
Yeah, that was weird.
So then I'm right, there is no real Dr. Frankenstein in the past?
No.
Okay. I'm curious how an Elorian would have brought it up.
There are lots of references to 20th century culture, and in particular 20th century Western culture, that alien species seem to reference. So in particular, I think, doesn't Armus have a go at Data for being Tin Man? And you think, you mean like from The Wizard of Oz? And you think, yeah. Well, how the hell did he know about the... I mean, is it from the book or is it from the West End musical that Armus managed to get this cultural reference? Mm-hmm.
You got to remember that Guinan in Time's Arrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. Guinan, you get a pass for Guinan.
Yeah,
I can't remember. No, it wasn't Armus, was it? It was Nagilum, possibly.
It was Armus. No, he called...
No, Nagilum was the one who wanted to experiment on half the ship's crew to death.
Right.
Armus was the one that killed...
Yeah.
But he asked Data what he thought about that and called him a robot. And he actually called him...
He gets called Tin Man by someone. And it's just a cultural reference.
Yeah, it's silly. Well, Armus was watching The Wizard of Oz at one point.
Yeah, he had a lot of time on that planet. You know, he had the box set.
Yeah, he had the box set. He
got through all the classics.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Maybe got it from Riker's head. Okay, so anyway, she asked, what do you know about this bit? I mean, what do you know about her? That's healthy for a boy his age. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So back to...
What does he mean by that?
I don't know, but the only thing that I got from this episode was Beverly Crusher wants Wesley to be like any other teenager and basically be a pain in the ass.
But this is healthy for him. Now,
yeah, this is healthy to throw tantrums and have a go at your parents and date chicks and get drunk, and even though you can't get drunk in the future, but you know.
You know, we didn't discuss this point, but what do you think about Wesley's interaction with Crusher? I mean, does it make any sense that he's just like an ass to her? And she's just like trying to intrude on him?
This is what she wants. She wants him to be a teenager. If all teenagers have this phase, rebellious phase, all teenagers do it. You know, we did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when she actually does it, when he does what she wants him to do, which is be a teenager, she doesn't like it.
Mm-mm. She don't understand it. He's not the same as when she left.
Yeah.
Well, he grew up.
And when he snaps her and says, you wasn't even here, you know, you never scoped me, you know, mm-hmm. have you not heard of email? You know, what have you been doing for a year apart from banging admirals? You know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, slutting yourself around a starbase.
Yeah, you come here and having a go at me because I'm working, but you've been like, you know.
Well, she did. She did snap back and say, you know, the comm system works both ways. No, she said, well, I'm here now, Wesley.
Yeah, I'm here now, Wesley, because the admirals all had to get infections sorted.
Yes, but you can't touch me for a few days.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Once I finish the cream treatment, we're fine.
here's another thing. Why was there no welcome back Dr. Crusher party?
Picard had a private one for her.
I don't think there was anything left over from the please go away Pulaski party.
Yeah, right. No one said goodbye.
Oh, that was the other thing. That was the other thing I've got in my notes. The Enterprise at the start says it's in a geosynchronous orbit. Right. Now, correct me if I'm wrong here, James, but that means the ship maintains the same position, yeah?
Yeah, relative to the body it's orbiting.
Yeah. So why is it when the shuttle leaves the back of the ship is looking at the star?
Yeah, I noticed that as well. what they had is that they had a nice graphic of the star, and they positioned it wherever they could out of every window and every shuttle bay, and whenever they had an external shot, they needed it in the background. But it's not geometrically consistent throughout the episode.
Yeah, so basically they spent an awful lot of money on this image, and we're going to get our money's worth.
Yes. And the two guys in the control room are still working hard. Okay, then. I guess...
They're like Miles O'Brien. They never leave.
No, they have to stay.
Yeah.
We still have to figure out what O'Brien does all day long. I mean, they're not transporting...
There's a meme on the internet. I'll have to find it and send you the link in an email. There's a meme on the internet of O'Brien in the transporter room. And he's standing, it's a series of pictures, and the first five, he doesn't move at all. No one comes in, no one comes out. And then in the last picture, I think it's the fifth or sixth picture, he says, "Do you know I could just beam everyone off this ship if I wanted to?"
Right. Just like the Voyager episode where they are beaming the crew members off as they're beaming the alien on.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody would know that he's doing it. Because obviously the computer doesn't alert that somebody is leaving the ship. They just, you know, they answer the question, where's the captain? Captain's not on the ship. So, I mean, he could beam people right off the ship and no one would ever know. Or beam somebody who's sleeping from their bed to somewhere else. And when they wake up, they're in the middle of a crowd. Why couldn't he do that?
Have you always noticed when they go to a room where someone's working on their own, they're always tapping away at the panel?
Yes.
I reckon they're on the internet.
That's what it has to be. Because then I asked a question a long time ago. Why is it that nobody played a practical joke on Odo when he was regenerating, beaming his pal onto a holo suite of the station being destroyed? You know, he wakes up out of this and he wakes up in the middle of this battle or war zone, only to find out later it's actually on the holosuite. That would have been funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not the oatmeal toss, but... All right, I think we've beat this one enough, and it's after 11 o'clock, so you guys want to go to bed, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Me, I still got another 6 hours. I'm waiting for dinner. Okay, so let's go into our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being terrible, and 5 being the best. And, of course, I'll start. This was an okay episode. I would have hoped for more of a season opener, but I liked the challenge that Stubb faced and the ridiculousness of the crew not doing what they needed to do to solve the situation. I don't know, I'm still of the mind of, we can experiment later with some nanites, but for now, let's just do what we gotta do to save the ship, and then, when everything is fine, we'll put a couple nanites together and see in a more controlled environment and see what happens. But unfortunately, because this is a 24th century evolution of morals, we've pulled this genie out of the can, and we're going to have to do something to solve it legitimately. I do believe this was the catalyst for the formation of the Borg Collective, and I'm talking behind the scenes in the writer's room. I had a feeling that this sparked something. Dr. Crusher is back. By the end of Season 2, I kind of grew to like Pulaski, and I didn't think I would at the beginning of Season 2, but I am in the end glad that she's not around. I would like to figure out what happened to Dr. Pulaski, I mean, the character, not the actress, actor. We got to come up with a solution of why Dr. Pulaski is no longer on the ship. And where she's at. Maybe she's now the head of Starfleet Medical to cure the admirals of their diseases. Who knows? It's not exactly all the best, but it's not all worst. So I'm going to probably give it 3 nanites. Colin, let's go for you next. Should have let you go first, but...
That's your show. it's, as I said at the start, I like this because I like the contrast between Stubbs and Wesley. And basically Stubbs is what Wesley could be if he carries on with his like linear obsession line of thinking. But we all know that Wesley becomes something completely different. But I also, I think the low-key return of Dr. Crusher was kind of odd. You know, no one, you never actually seen anyone say to her, welcome back on board. So I thought that was a bit weird. But then again, you know, from our perspective, we're saying she's just come back. But from a continuity point of view, she could have been back for a while. Although she does say to Stubbs, I've just got back from Starfleet Medical for a year. I think it's interesting how they tackle obsessive personality. And there's also, there is some inadvertent comedy elements in it, like Guinan, when she says, like, I run a clean place when he's playing traps. There's also, you know, Data doing one of his odd voices. That was quite funny, even though it was unintentional. And also, depending on what you watch it on, I mean, I watched this on Blu-ray, so the special effects on the Blu-ray really, really do show the star and the explosion and all that to a really great effect. The only thing that it's basically a Wesley episode as opposed to his mom returning episode. But it's another instance of why you should not let people who haven't got Starfleet training run a ship, because yet again he nearly destroys the Enterprise. And the only thing that really got me about this is at no point does anyone have a go at him for effectively destroying the Enterprise and a man's life's work.
Right.
But so there's plus points and there's minus points, so I'd give it a 3.
A 3, okay. Give it a 3. How about you, Doc?
Okay, so this is a bit strange. I didn't actually know where I was going to be coming in today. I've kind of enjoyed our conversation. Actually, some of the stuff that we skirted around is some of the stuff that I have the biggest problems with. Because I like the episode in general. I think it's a good premise that they've set up. It's relatively nicely executed. I like Crusher being back. I actually don't mind the Wesley story. I think it's nice that they have the scientist character, even though I don't think he's quite as nice a scientist as they should really be portraying, because scientists are good people. I don't like how they play fast and loose with like the concept of evolution and how they've actually created this new race of nanites, and there are lots of jumps that happen, and certainly as the episode's wrapping up, that to me I was just sitting there thinking, you what? So you go from, first of all, everyone accepts that, the nanites are alive and they're intelligent, and then just out of nowhere, Data suggests that we'll be able to communicate with them, and everyone seems to nod and go along for the ride, and then he suggests that they can, inhabit his body and then now have a negotiated peace, and, we're talking about things that were created, even if they are intelligent, they pretty got no context to imagine the world that that people would exist on if they were humans or human-like people. So you're moving from the world of being interested in stuff around the cell level to being interested in, 2-meter guys wandering around, breathing air and stuff. And I just didn't think that there would be such a divide between those two set of life forms that I find the idea of, nanite man coming out and negotiating a peace treaty to be just overly ridiculous. I also like the way that then they manage to find a planet, Cavus Alpha 4, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And they dumped the nanites there, and you know, no doubt in 6 months' time, Cavis Alpha 5 is going to explode and cause them a hell of a trouble. Eventually, they're going to come up with a way of getting off the planet and seeking Picard and getting their vengeance.
Oh, God, I got image now of Picard saying, nanites!
There you go. Okay. Go on.
But actually, I think that maybe this episode is, you know, more than the sum of its parts in a way. I was coming in at a 3. I thought, as we discussed it, I would be, you know, would be slightly highballing that. But I think in the end, we've kind of like agreed that this is a relatively, you know, it's a good episode of Star Trek that is, you know, it's not perfect in any way. And I think, you know, I come in at a 3 on this.
Okay, 3 it is. Three all around. That's unusual. Anything else you guys want to bring up real quick?
No, I'm gone.
You're good? James? Yeah. All right.
ChiefO'Brien@work.com.
ChiefO'Brien@work.com.
Absolutely.
Okay, I do have to check that out.
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation, a hostile alien race threatens to annihilate an entire planet.
The lives of 15,000 people are riding on you.
We are not leaving.
Data's mission, force an evacuation.
You will die, and their weapons are far more powerful.
But his own life is in jeopardy. On Star Trek, The Next Generation.
All right. Well, then, this will bring us to the end of our episode. So join us next week as we review Season 3, Episode 2, The Ensigns of Command. And if you notice at the forums, we haven't done our forum feedback. We actually are going to make a change this season, and we'll talk about it in a little bit because it's going to be after the show. So, I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Colin from England.
Oh, and another thing I forgot to mention, guys. At this time, we have no one on for the survivors. Anybody want to take it?
What's the date?
The 25th.
Of this month?
Yes. So, if not, send a lewtrekshow@gmail.com that you want to do the survivors. First come, first served.
So, thanks for having me on, guys. It's been an absolute blast.
Okay, all right. And so, what I said earlier about the forum feedback thing, I was thinking, and I don't know. James, what do you think about the idea of doing the forum at the end? And the reason why I say it is some people might not like hearing forums in the middle of a show. I know I don't. I really don't. I don't get into them all that much because of the fact that we read the forum posts ourselves and we sometimes even reply to them. That means others might, but that way we put it at the end of the show and whoever really wants the forums can hang on until then, or they can choose to click off and skip the forums. What do you think of that idea?
I think that sounds good. I think that sounds good.
All right. And
it took me around 30 seconds to realize that you'd got back into the show mode.
Yeah, right. Well, I can get in and back out quick. And, of course, I'll try and remind everybody about this next week, but I'll probably forget.
I'm sure you won't forget, Lou.
No, I know for a fact. Either. If I forget, you'll remind me. Okay. Nobody gets the secret sauce. All right, so let's go into forum feedback. And as I say that, I still haven't gone into forum feedback. And we left off season 2 with peak performance, right?
It's peak performance time.
It yes. is. All right, so let's do a search for peak because I'm stupid enough not to do it in advance. And here we go. Who wants to be on a TNG podcast? Hey, that was one I put down a long time ago. Okay, peak performance, and oh Lord. So would you like to start with Kieran's?
I will, but do you know what, Lou? I think I might get you back next week.
Why? You think, think you're going to make me do the first one, aren't you?
Next week, I suspect I will, yes.
Okay. Maybe I'll just slip it in and make it sound like I wasn't thinking or something, and I just went straight into it.
Okay, so the first forum feedback is from Kieran McDuff, and thank you once again, Kieran, for getting that top spot and also getting a relatively good apparently 1,200 words worth of forum feedback. So first, Ben mentions reverse psychology and then says he hates this episode. Am I the only one who got that right at the start? And I have to say that I got that as well. I got that. And I especially got it when I was listening back. I have to disagree that Data wouldn't have learned these lessons by this point in time. And I thought Ben made this point very well. As far as I'm concerned, this is a very niche area of humanity. As such, there's no reason Data would have competed in any sport prior to this, which I reckon is slightly different from competing in your position at work, which you rightly said he would have to have done. Mm. Of course, we've already seen it in this season. As far as games goes, he's only just been introduced to poker. Data tries to play poker very logically, but he loses because he just does that and doesn't factor in the human factor of bluffing. I guess it's the same here. We don't know enough about the rules of Stratagema to know for sure, but there's bound to be an emotional aspect to it which Data wouldn't understand. There's usually no logic in taking certain risks in a game in an effort to win that game, so I would expect Data tries to win in a logical manner and ends up losing precisely because of that. Actually, I have to say, let me just go off the post for a little while. I've once had a job interview where they asked us to play some type of, you know, logical game, and you know they asked you to take, you had to bet based on, you know, your hand versus what the other person's hand was going to be. And I have to say that, you know, being someone who's done maths or been a mathematician, apparently the other dude knew straight away what exactly I was holding based on how I bet. So on the grounds that I knew what my odds were and I actually put that down, it allowed them to specifically immediately know where I stood. And I suspect, you know, it's similar here with a Data, I suppose. This isn't a new concept. In Star Trek, Kirk and Spock playing chess should be a simple win for the logical Spock every time, except that it's not, because Kirk can go off the logical path to beat him. Indeed, we see this all the way into Voyager with Tuvok and Kim. It's pretty much a Star Trek trope, and I think it's almost too easy to say Data is acting a bit too childlike here. Okay, other aspects. Burke. I know the word, and I tend to think of door trap rather than an idiot. Burke, feed me. That's probably another UK reference, though. Mm-hmm. Actually, I have the same. I do not get the reference. No. I think it must be a UK thing, but I don't get it myself. Ooh. Another point you focused on was whether or not Wesley cheated. I'd say he didn't. Indeed, improvising is a great word for it. I'd say Worf does the same, and I agreed it's least on par with what Wesley does. Ultimately, it's using what you can get hold of, even if that includes stealing from your enemy. In fact, as James said, they did it in the best of both worlds too. Indeed, maybe this episode really did set them up nicely for defeat in the Borg. The moral of the story? Use everything you can, especially if you can use the enemy's equipment against them. Sleep.
Yeah.
But here's the issue that I have with this episode. In Q Who, we saw the Enterprise crew take an absolute battering when it came to their arrogance. They thought they were cock of the walk, and so Q went out of his way to show them just how far they were from that. So what's with all the arrogance on the Enterprise here? Oh, the poor Hathaway, we'll beat them easily, they're no match for us. Oh look, we've been outthought, it's not even believable because it underestimated their fellow crewmates. Surely they would have known better than that. Nevertheless, do you really want to be this blasé about having an overwhelming advantage like this? The Borg. Maybe it's in keeping with this episode, but here we see another side of the coin of the human emotion. The logical thing would be to blow away the Hathaway without being so cocky. That's what the Borg would have probably done, if they had perceived it as a threat. But they don't. They act cocky and they get shown up for it. A good question at the end of the episode. Who's right at the end, Picard or Kal Rami? Well, for me it's clearly Picard, since they got out of it in one piece. Mm-hmm. Had there been no other way out of it, then maybe you could argue that Kal Rami was right. But in this case, there was a way out, so everyone survived. I'd argue that you only ever sacrifice people when you're in a no-win situation. You know, like, I need warp speed in 3 minutes or we're all dead. Mm-hmm. Mind you, how exactly did Worf override the Ferengi sensors?
surely he would need codes to do that, and he's only got them for the Enterprise, so he's and he only has them for the Enterprise because he's been an active crew member. He shouldn't have anything of that sort for the Ferengi. I suppose you can always hack into their systems.
Yeah, I got a feeling.
But and then you're reliant on then the systems of the Ferengi not being, you know, up to scratch. As for the Ferengi themselves, I've never been a fan of the Ferengi, and I've said as much on other topics. They were very badly done in Next Generation, and they were basically a joke every time they showed up. Mm-hmm. This episode doesn't help, as they're pretty much as a dumb bad guy here. Deep Space Nine does a good job taking them and rebranding them as a less bad guy and more of a misunderstood species that we come to understand more as they progress in the series.
Mm-hmm.
Mind you, that change takes them on a different route where I still don't like them for completely different reasons, but that's a separate issue.
Mm.
I do agree with James, though, that the Ferengi Marauder was a terrific design of ship. It's just a shame that we never actually saw them do anything. I'm glad that Ben brought up Pulaski again. I think she does a great job with Data in this episode, and it completes her arc from he's a tool to be used to he's a child to be taught.
Mm.
Okay, you could have said she used him to knock Kaurami down a peg or two, but I always got the impression that she did this because she trusted Data could do just that. After Data didn't win, she had to take him under her wing and help him through it. If she didn't care about Data, she wouldn't have done that. He would have just been a flawed tool. For me, the key here is the question, would Pulaski have used him if it hadn't been Data, but had been someone that was flesh and blood? I would have said that she probably would have done. This isn't an Android issue in my view. Whether using someone in this manner is right or wrong, probably wrong. But I can't say that I wouldn't have wanted to bring Kaurami down a peg or two myself. He's far too cocky. Even more so than the Enterprise crew when battling against the Hathaway. So for me, this episode ends brilliantly. I love it when he throws a strop and he storms out of 10 forward. I enjoy this episode, but there's a few strange things that I don't fully understand. The cockiness doesn't fit, and Worf's magic ability to confuse the Ferengi systems isn't explained properly. But overall, I like the War Games idea. I appreciate the Kaurami character for what he is, someone to dislike for his cockiness, but someone who probably feels he has earned the right to be cocky.
Mm.
I would have killed to see more of this kind of War Games aspect, even if Starfleet is about exploration. It's a shame they didn't use it more in Deep Space Nine, actually, especially given the story arc there. I think I'd have to rank this 4 out of 5. There are a few annoying flaws, but I think I can see past them to a decent enough story around a good idea.
Okay. Yeah, we give it 4 as well. Cool. Thank you. All right. So Colin, who we just had on. First, he says, first off, let me say that it's nice to hear Ben back on the show. I think it's great. What? Colin, dude, you've got to go back and rewrite this. I'm going to read this as it probably was meant to be written. First off, let me say it's nice to hear Ben back on the show. I think he is a great podcaster, and he does have some great thoughts and insights into Trek. I would like to start by adding to what our learned friend Mr. McDuff has said above. Logic, as Spock said it, is the beginning of wisdom. To this end, human ability, as Kirk said in the motion picture, to leap beyond logic is one of our strengths. This enables us to outwit linear thinking. I do, however, have some problems with this story. First off, Wesley once again saves the day. Although in this case, it's in the form of a seriously old starship against a modern Ferengi. But it could so easily have been against a Federation flagship. I mean, really? So, the old concept of three flagships... The old concept of three flagship possibly struggling against an aging Hulk bothered me. I thought of it as divisive, disservice to Picard and the crew and ship. Then there is a way that Picard mentions how good Riker is, yet seems to underestimate his own crew's ability to the point where they let the boy genius beam back aboard for a scientific experiment, in quotes, but don't question what it is or notice him beaming it back. And that's where I think it's cheating, because, again, like I said in the show, there's no way that you're going to beam aboard a Romulan ship just before it engages you in battle to get something on it that will help you defeat that Romulan ship. So, to me, it's cheating. The Ferengi fall into the mold we could have come to expect in TNG, which is comic relief. But as Kieran said, they don't really gain any credence until DS9. I'm not a fan of the ship design either, by the way. But the ship itself warrants a mention. In the past, they have been able to hold their own, whereas in other episodes it was easy to defeat. So come on, writers, make up your mind. One final thing, Data and Pulaski. In this case, I think she actually shows concern about him. But still, as a whole, she is androphobiac. Androidphobiac. So it's called Enlightened Society. She sees him as a machine, pure and simple, and says so. Heaven knows what she would have made of Voyager's EMH. Good. That's a good one. How would Pulaski have treated the EMH?
What the thing about the EMH, right, is that by the time you do get to him, you've somewhat regressed in terms of artificial life. Or the respect shown towards artificial life, because you still have data around and you have respect given to data, but as soon as the EMH is created, it's completely accepted that he's not alive in any way, shape, or form, and you know even Janeway treats him fundamentally as such throughout Voyager's run. So I wouldn't, you know, I don't think she would have really considered the EMH to be a legitimate life form at all.
Right. So I don't think she would have treated him very well. Okay. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for that forum feedback. And again, we will be doing these at the end of the episode from now on. So please let us know in the next forum feedback for this one if this is the way you like it. Should we go back? We will do what you want. But of course, it's a consensus thing. If everybody wants us to do it, we'll do it. Okay, well then, I guess that's it. Take care and good night again, guys.